Case number 13-3174, Judy versus Holder. And it's Mr. Shaw. Good morning.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Zach Shaw. I'm representing petitioner Jean Judy. So the principal question in this case is whether the government has carried its heavy burden to establish Congress's intent to apply the Stop Crime Rule retroactively. So in 1995, petitioner had a choice. He could take his low-level drug possession charge to trial, or he could plead guilty. If he chose the latter, he'd become deportable. But he could also know that he'd be eligible for discretionary relief in just a year and a half, as long as he got to 7 years total of lawful permanent residency. And petitioner took that deal. The BIA's decision below altered that deal. It interpreted the stop time rule, which was enacted in 1996 after that plea bargain, to retroactively make petitioner's 1995 crime disqualifying.
Yes, and it seems to me that the difficult point for Mr. Judy is showing detrimental reliance on the laws that stood before the stop time rule was enacted. He can't show that he took any particular action or gave up some right in reliance on the law as it was prior to the effective date of the ERIRA, can he? Because it would seem he was just passively waiting for the clock to reach 7 years.
So we don't think he needs to show reliance, and we think that the Supreme Court was very clear about that in the Vardalos case. But even if we needed to show reliance, I think we amply meet that burden. And the reason is the deal he made in 1995. So he could have taken this charge to trial. He could have put the government to its proof, required them to show their case to a jury, but instead he pled guilty. He gave up those rights. And part of the deal he made when he gave up those rights was that he would continue to accrue residency credit towards that 7 years. And he actually got there.
So are you saying that he does not have to show detrimental reliance in order for us to hold for him at the second step of the retroactivity analysis? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, respectfully, Your Honor, I think the Supreme Court was very clear in the Vardalos case that reliance need not be shown at the second step. So in that case, it was about the retroactivity of another provision of ERIRA, which related to the ability to travel abroad and come home without undergoing an admission proceeding. And the Second Circuit there had said, well, you can't meet your burden at the second step of the Landgraf because you haven't shown reliance. And the Supreme Court said we've never required reliance.
Well, it's held that it's not necessary. And my concurrence in De Horta Garcia sets forth the reasons. So I'm just the devil's advocate here. But the law of this circuit is that actual reliance must be shown. If you take a look at Kocha versus Holder.
I guess I want to make a quick point about Vardalos and then just go back to why we show actual reliance. So one of the things that this court said in Zivkovic, for example, is that, you know, Vardalos may require this circuit to reconsider the role of actual reliance. So I think that's an open question. But I'm not sort of happy here to embrace that standard if that's what's needed, because the reliance here is taking the deal in 1995, giving up these valuable trial rights, and saving the government the burden of having to prove its case. The government now has gotten the benefit of that bargain.
Counsel, are you arguing actual reliance or more something just where we ought to assume that because of the structure of the choices that he faced?
Your Honor, I thanks for the clarification. What I mean is, given the position that he was in, we assume that petitioners in these sorts of circumstances generally rely, and that's why under
St. Cyr... As in Padilla or something, or St. Cyr or something like that.
Right, right? So the petitioner in St. Cyr had never shown that he, in fact, made his choice whether to go to trial or not based on the availability of discretionary relief. the Supreme Court's point was, given how important discretionary relief is to non-citizens and how often it's in fact granted, that preserving or not the ability to take advantage of that mechanism is enough that we essentially presume reliance in a guilty plea case. Now, there are harder questions that can come up in other circumstances that I know this court and others have grappled with. So suppose you take your case to trial, but you claim that you somehow alter your trial strategy based on the availability or not of discretionary relief. Those are hard questions. I think our case is not, because petitioner, again, made a deal that was predicated on the ability to continue to accrue residency credit until he got to his 7 years. And again, it's somewhat significant that he made it to 7 years before Arriaga's effective date. And we think that that's more than enough to show reliance, any reliance required to the second step of Landgraf.
Mr. Schaff, can I ask you a real simple question? At least I hope it's simple. But tell me about Mr. Judy's legal status as of, I believe, March 31st, 1997, the day before IRERA took effect. What was his status with respect to, in any relevant way?
So, I mean, I guess his status was he was a lawful permanent resident. He was deportable by virtue of this 1995 offense, but he was eligible for discretionary relief. So if you want to take a snapshot of, you know, March 31st on the one hand and April 1st on another, then under the BIA's view of the stop time rule, he ends up much worse off, by virtue of the retroactive application of
At that point, he met the seven-year requirement, right?
And by that point, he had met the seven-year requirement.
Okay.
Yes, and the government doesn't dispute that.
Has he had any other brushes with the law other than those that are set forth in the briefs? I'm just curious about what his odds are of obtaining discretionary relief, assuming we agree with you that the stop time rule doesn't apply to him.
I mean, he's had some other brushes with the law. So, for example, one of the grounds that was charged here and tossed by the immigration judge was he had a firearms possession offense in 1989 before he became a lawful permanent resident, which is why that was not a ground for removal here. And there are some other fairly low-level things. I mean, it's not like he went out and robbed banks. But I think fundamentally our point with respect to that, Your Honor, is all we're looking for is the chance to apply for discretionary relief, and none of the conduct that he's engaged in is of the type that Congress has deemed sufficient to entirely exclude him from the opportunity to invoke the Attorney General's discretion.
Are you aware of any data on how many people like Mr. Judy commit offenses that render them deportable in theory, but who in fact remain in the country for many years before they're finally served with notices to appear? Because it seems to me that we see that scenario very frequently, but I just wondered if you are aware of how common that is.
So I don't have any data for you. I have anecdotes. So, you know, one of the cases that's on point with ours is a case, the Jennery case in the Western District of Michigan. This person had been entered the country in 1969, pled guilty to an offense in 1974, and then found in something like 2001 that this offense 40 years later was deemed to have cut off their permanent residency status for purposes of applying for discretionary relief. And the other thing I can tell you is what
an appeal is pending in that?
Sorry?
A petition for review is pending in that, or what?
That's one of the cases that we just So the other thing I can tell you about just the statistics that I think is relevant is the Supreme Court's emphasis in Sancerre that once you are in the position of being able to apply for discretionary relief, as of 1996 or 2001, about half of the applications were granted. So the ability to apply for this form of relief is of fundamental importance for non-citizens, and that's the reason why that's the reason why Sancerre regarded this ability as such a fundamental part of the quid pro quo that non-citizens engage in when they're making a decision about whether to go to trial or whether to plead guilty. So we've sort of talked a little bit about the second part of Landgraf, but I sort of want to go back to our statutory arguments if there's no further questions there. So on the statute, I think we have two ways to win. We win if the word's just right about the better reading of the statute, or we win if we're in Landgraf and the government doesn't meet the high burden required to show a clear congressional statement. And that burden is really, really high. So the way the Supreme Court's put it is you have to find an unambiguous statement of unmistakable clarity that leaves no doubt that Congress itself has affirmatively considered the potential unfairness of retroactive effect. And in this case, we just think we're right about the better reading of the statute, but at a bare minimum, the statute doesn't come close to meeting that burden. Sort of two points to make about that. There's nothing expressed in the language itself. It just refers to the clock stopping on residency when the non-citizen has committed certain crimes. But we think the fundamental point about the statute is more the structure. So in order to be eligible for this form of cancellation as a lawful permanent resident, you have to have three things: 5 years of permanent residency, 7 years of residency in any status as modified by the stop time rule, and you can't have ever been convicted of an aggravated felony bar. And when Congress took those provisions and was thinking about which of these should apply retroactively, it expressly made the aggravated felony bar retroactive. It said it applies to any felony committed before, on, or after the date of its enactment. And we think that that creates a powerful negative inference about the stop time rule. It left out similar language there, even though it was very focused on precisely these questions. And we think that's what lets us, but not the petitioner in Sancir or Bartlett, actually prevail even without the presumption coming into play. But at a bare minimum, that strong negative inference, we believe, shows that as a matter of Landgraf step one, our case is essentially a fortiori from Sancir or Bartlett, and if I may reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you. Ms. Mercia, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Lisa S. Mercia of the Office of Immigration Litigation for the respondent. There is one primary issue before the Court today, whether the Board properly determined that the stop time rule under Section 248D1B of the Immigration Nationality Act, which took effect as part of the Legal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, ARERA, on April 1, 1997, terminated Mr. Judy's continuous presence as of the date that he committed a controlled substance offense in 1995 and rendered him ineligible for cancellation of removal.
In terms of the first prong of the retroactivity inquiry, I just have a hard time finding a clear statement that Congress intended for the stop time rule to apply to convictions that predated the rule. I mean, can you give me a succinct statement of what you think constitutes clear evidence of such an intent?
Well, first of all, there are sort of two parts to that in some ways. First of all, we're talking about the stop time rule as applied to a form of relief that was created by ARERA. Cancellation of removal was created by ARERA, and the stop time rule applies to cancellation of removal. So that's the first point, that the language of the statute is very clear, that it refers to any period of continuous residence or continuous physical presence in the United States when the alien has committed an offense referred to under Section 1182A2 and removable from the United States under Section 1227A2. And both of those parts of the statute refer to enactments under ARERA. So that's the sort of first point, that the statutory text is referring to cancellation of removal. The second point, which, as we pointed out in our brief, and that Heaven versus Gonzalez in the Fifth Circuit goes through, is that Congress was very clear in its, I guess it's a going through the transitional rules as amended by NACARA.
Amended by what?
By NACARA.
What is NACARA?
The Nicaraguan, let me make sure that I get that right, just because.
Are you talking about the 1997 legislation?
Yes.
To correct the problems in the 1996 legislation?
Yes, the Nicaraguan Adjustment and Central American Relief Act.
Okay, we're dealing with enough acronyms.
So, first of all, in ARERA, in the transitional rules, they specifically made sure to mention that that the stop time rule, or their enactment of the stop time rule, would apply to notices of to appear issued before, on, or after the date of enactment of
right.
the Act.
Right, you've got a clear statement as to those cases.
Yes. Well, it's labeled the transitional rule with regard to suspension of deportation. So essentially what Congress was trying to do was to make sure that this stop time rule was going to apply to cases that were already in proceedings and where suspension of deportation was the relief being applied, because the statute already applies to cancellation of removal. So the transitional rules was very clear that they wanted the stop time rule to apply to cases pre-ARERA and post-ARERA. So the post-ARERA transitional rules.
I okay. lost you.
Okay.
This is not a clear statement to me. Okay.
It's not a succinct statement.
Well, I'm sorry. Well, basically what I would say is that Congress, in their transitional rules and in the amendment afterwards, they made sure to include the language that it applies to before, on, or after cases. That's the way that I would put it most simply. That these
aren't you reading a lot into what Congress actually said?
Well, Congress put this in the Act. I mean, there's no reading into it when that is their exact language.
It says on, during, after.
It actually, I'm reading from the rule right now. It says transitional rule with regard to suspension of deportation. So it is referring to cases pre-ARERA where it was where people were applying for suspension of deportation, not cancellation removal. But they say paragraphs 1 and 2 of Section 248D, which is the stop time rule, of the Immigration Nationality Act relating to continuous residence or physical presence shall apply to notices to appear issued before, on, or after the date of the enactment.
Right.
NACARA, I'm sorry, please.
Well, let me try coming at this from a different way. From your perspective, what was Mr. Judy's legal status on March 31st, 1997, the day before ARERA took effect?
I forgot to answer that in two parts, actually. I would agree with the petitioner that on March 31st, right before ARERA, he was deportable because of his controlled substance offense.
He's an LP. He's a lawful permanent resident. Right?
Yes. Yeah, he's a lawful permanent resident.
He's deportable.
He is deportable. And at that point, he was eligible for 212C. However, in this case, that is not the question. The question is his eligibility for cancellation of removal.
That's my question, but you can explain to me why that's not relevant.
That's irrelevant in this case, because what the petitioner is trying to do is sort of skip over a step. He's trying to apply his eligibility for 212C relief to his eligibility for cancellation of removal. And that is really the question in this case in some ways, because he's trying to leapfrog the analysis of a 212C relief onto his eligibility of cancellation of removal. The stop time rule is very clear here that the commission of an offense.
If the stop time rule applies, he loses. We get that.
Yeah.
The question is whether you can change his status retroactively, whether you can change in a very serious negative way the consequences for that 1995 conviction.
Well, Your Honor, in some ways I think it would be useful to work back from where we are right now. So right now, the petitioner is removable on two grounds. And he's applying for cancellation of removal a discretionary waiver of his removability on those two grounds. The fact is if he had applied for 212C relief when he was eligible and had been granted 212C relief when he was eligible, he would not be eligible for cancellation of removal now. So the difficulty there is that he's trying to essentially say, because I was eligible for 212C relief, I am now eligible for cancellation of removal relief. And those two things don't actually equate.
If Mr. Judy had met with an immigration lawyer after he was convicted in 1995, and he had said, look, should I just self-deport given my conviction, or should I wait and see if I can make it to the seven-year threshold before the government tries to deport me? What do you think a competent immigration lawyer would have told him?
In 1995? Mm-hmm. He was deportable at that point. What advice a immigration lawyer would give him, I honestly can't speculate. But now, at this point...
I'm asking you to speculate.
But, I mean... Your Honor mentioned he had a considerable criminal history by that point. He'd had a firearms offense. And since then, he has certainly engaged in quite a number of criminal acts as well. So whether or not a lawyer would say, wait longer, don't wait, possibly wait, speculating is irrelevant at that point.
What would the downside have been for waiting at that point?
Yeah. The downside of waiting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the downside...
If he wants to stay in the United States long term, what's the downside of waiting in 1995?
The downside of applying then, or the downside of...
Just trying to wait out. Just trying to get to that seven-year threshold.
Honestly, I wouldn't be able to speculate as to what his personal thinking would be then. Certainly the record doesn't reflect any of that. If your honors are referring to step two of Landgraf and his reliance on this, there's no evidence in the record there's no presumption here that he was relying for any particular reason.
Could you address the language in Vartelis that says reliance is not necessary for these sorts of arguments?
I think, Your Honor, that the petitioner here is throwing out the bath with the bathwater, I think is the phrase that goes. I mean,
the baby bath
with the bathwater. I'm sorry. I had it a minute ago. Your Honor, the petitioner here is reading Vartelis to completely throw out reliance, but this court has already stated in Zdikovic that is too expansive a reading in Vartelis, and certainly all of the mostly unpublished cases that have considered Vartelis has recognized that Vartelis wasn't completely throwing out reliance. It was simply stating that in examining a new legal disability, that the concept was that the courts in examining the Landgraf factors and examining new legal disability shouldn't be only focusing on detrimental reliance. Reasonable reliance is essentially the language that Landgraf and subsequent decisions has had. But to that effect, to the extent that the petitioner is relying on St. Cyr certainly focuses on reliance in these type of cases. And
well,
it focuses
Cyr,
on reliance
so,
in
St. Cyr basically assumes reliance, right? It's not as though Mr. St. Cyr came in and testified, I was advised by my lawyer, this is the law, therefore I made the decision, right?
But again, Your Honor, this is a different circumstance than St. Cyr.
I mean, I know that. I'm talking about the more general language in Vartelis that tells us broadly that when we're talking about retroactive imposition of disabilities, we assume reliance even when the conduct in question is morally reprehensible or illegal. there's a degree of unfairness inherent whenever the law imposes additional burdens based on conduct that occurred in the past. Without reliance, that's still the problem. Without subjective reliance, my lawyer told me this, this was my strategy, and you, the immigration judge, should believe me.
No, St. Cyr definitely uses that language, but again, if the question here is the two steps of Landgraf and how it's applied in these type of cases.
Landgraf, yeah.
I'm sorry?
I thought I was quoting Landgraf.
Oh, I'm sorry.
As quoted in Vartelis.
Well, I would refer, Your Honor, to other parts of Landgraf then. In Landgraf, Landgraf says essentially, though it's long embraced a presumption against statutory retroactivity, it doesn't necessarily apply, it recognizes that not in every circumstance will there be an impermissible retroactive effect by retroactive application. And because of that, in step two of Landgraf, it examines the factors of Landgraf that we look to whether or not there was any new legal disability imposed. So Landgraf, you don't just stop after you determine that something has been retroactive. The question of new legal disability has to be examined. And to the extent that in this court, and certainly in its various examinations of retroactivity, it's embraced the concept of reliance. I'm sorry, I'm out of time.
Did you just finish? Of course.
To the extent that this court has looked to reliance, the question here is whether or not after the petitioner has essentially been found removable on two grounds, and he's trying to piggyback the concept that he should have been eligible for 212C relief onto cancellation of removal and the stop time rule. And the fact is that he's not eligible for cancellation of removal according to the stop time rule because he committed two grounds of removability, and he can't piggyback the fact that he would have been eligible for 212C relief onto his eligibility for cancellation of removal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Will you add another minute, please, for Mr. Shao? So now you have 3 minutes.
Great. So I'm going to try to get through 3 points in my 3 minutes. So I want to start with the question about what would the advice from an immigration attorney have been before ERIRA? And I think that advice certainly would have been, stay in the country. You've been here for 22 years. You have no family left in Haiti. You're going to become eligible for discretionary relief. And once you're there, you at least have, as Sansur said, a 50-50 shot of getting there, of obtaining such relief. In other words, the attorney would have advised him to do exactly the thing that the immigrant in Sansur itself had done. Second, I want to address this question of, well, which statute are we applying under? And I think the important point about that is that this retroactivity analysis, as the Supreme Court has said, is supposed to be a common sense functional judgment where what we're looking for is congressional intent. So what we know about congressional intent here is that Congress intended for 1229B, which is what we're using, to be the replacement for 212C. And we also know that Congress intends to legislate against the backdrop of the presumption against retroactivity because it accords with legislative expectations, and I'm sort of paraphrasing Landgraf here. And when you put those two things together, what you get is that Congress intended the application of normal presumption against retroactivity principles to 1229B. And I don't think anything that the government has said alters that conclusion. The third point I want to make, and I'm going to sort of direct you to briefs here, is related to the transitional rule. This is a little complicated. We deal with it at pages 19 to 20 of our blue brief. But the core point is, to the extent the government is saying there's some incongruity here because you would have been, rather the stop time rule would have applied retroactively to you had this proceeding been brought before ERIRA's enactment, Two points about that. One, that is not a clear statement in the statute of the type that's required at Landgraf Step 1. Second, it's not even correct as a factual matter. So we make the point in our brief, that, which the government nowhere disputes, that the stop time rule makes retroactive not the stop time rule's trigger that relates to criminal grounds of deportation, but only the other one, which we haven't really talked about, which says your clock stops when you receive the equivalent of immigration documents, which before arrival were called orders to show cause and now are called notices to appear. That's all the retroactivity that Congress thought necessary for the transitional rules.
That's what they were really worried about, right?
I mean, that's absolutely what they were worried about.
Before IARERA, if I understand this correctly, before IARERA took effect, if you'd been served with a notice to appear, a deportation notice, if you could string things out long enough, the clock would run out and you'd be eligible for relief, right?
That's right. And our system, I mean, our view of the statute makes perfect sense with that purpose, which is exactly the thing that's in the legislative history. So the system you end up with is that if you received one of these immigration documents before ARIRA, then that stops your clock then and gets exactly the sort of gamesmanship Congress was targeting. And that's the function of the transitional rules. Going forward, the stop time rule also stops a residency clock on the issuance of immigration documents because it expressly says notices to appear, stop the clock. I see my time has expired, and we would ask that the board's decision be reversed and this case remanded.
Thank you so much. Were you appointed? No. But I have another question. Where do you go to law school?
So this court granted my... I am not actually a law student, notwithstanding how this was captioned. The court granted my motion. I'm a law clerk at the firm of Jenner & Block. I have passed the bar, but I won't be sworn in for another few months. And so since you asked, let me just say I appreciate the court's allowing me to argue today.
Well, we appreciate the terrific job you've done for your client, and we appreciate Jenner & Block, and we appreciate the government, and we're just full of appreciation. All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Case will be taken under advisement.